But eventually, even Mashler couldn't compete with Citron. One morning, Citron was sitting before his terminal, smirking and rubbing his hands like a ravenous gourmand eyeing a rack of lamb. The other Datech traders in the room looked on with envy. They knew he'd found a kill. It was just before the opening bell. Citron was flexing his neck muscles like an athlete, preparing for action. It was one of his favorite tricks, one Mashler had taught him. Before trading started, he'd search for a stock that was going to move sharply right out of the gate. Anything could cause it. Big news in the Wall Street Journal? A rumor on the grapevine. Citron didn't care about the details. He just wanted to know if the stock would move. And who didn't know it? Citron had found a live one. A stock that would be up about $2 a share in early trading. His next move was to hunt for a dealer who was asleep at the switch, or caught in traffic on the way to the office, and hadn't updated his quote from the previous day's session. Right at the open, Citron made his move. Using SOs, he bought 1,000 shares of stock from a market maker whose quote was stale. He then turned around and sold the shares seconds later at the new price. $2 higher, an instant $2,000 gain per trade, minus commissions. Citron executed the trade roughly 90 times that morning before the market maker changed the quote, amounting to a gain of more than $150,000 after fees. The market maker, of course, had just sold a huge chunk of the stock at an extremely low price, amounting to a paper loss of more than $150,000. Citron didn't give a shit about the market maker. He should have been in the office, glued to his terminal, if he was going to put quotes out. A quote was a quote. Done with his trade, Citron switched off his terminal, stood, and left the office, beaming. Later that day, he was back, his brand-new Mercedes-Benz 500 SL convertible parked out front. Driven by the frantic action of traders such as Citron, Datech quickly became one of the largest users of SOs on Wall Street, far outpacing Houtkin's operation. As Shelley Mashler and his team of traders at Datech kept pushing the envelope on SOs, they became enemy number one among NASDAQ's market makers. The hatred market makers felt for Datech went well beyond the everyday sparring matches that fueled Wall Street's Darwinian live-and-let-die routine. It was visceral, and at times, violent. Take Jerry Rosen. A market maker for Vanderbilt Securities, a broker-dealer across the street from Datech at 43 Broad Street, Rosen knew all about Mashler's old tricks. Mashler would do anything to get an order. He had no respect for his fellow market makers, Rosen thought, taking their shitty little 1,000-share orders on SOs and ruining the game for everybody. He'd known Mashler since the 1970s, when Mashler was an up-and-coming penny stock dealer in Jersey City. Rosen's boss at Vanderbilt was Morty Kantrowitz, an old-timer who'd helped Mashler get his start on Wall Street. His boss's connection with Mashler made Rosen paranoid. It seemed as if Datech's traders somehow knew about his positions. It was uncanny. Datech was constantly hitting the stocks he was trading, eating into his profits. Rosen was convinced Mashler had inside information about his positions and was banging his stocks on purpose. It was personal. Then, one morning, Rosen was looking to unload a large position in Airship International, a company that peddled ads on blimps. Out of the blue, Datech offered to sell a measly 1,000 shares of Airship stock for 25 cents less than what Rosen was offering. That meant Rosen could only sell his own stock for a cheaper price. He'd been sozed. Rosen snapped.
God damn it!
He screamed as the trade popped up on his level 2 workstation. Bursting out of his office, he darted across Broad Street and bolted up several flights of stairs. The door to Datech's office was open. In a rage, Rosen stepped inside.
You did it again! I'll fucking kill you! He screamed,
racing past Mashler, who was sitting at his desk, and leaping at a Datech trader named Freddie Balbi. Mashler grabbed a letter opener. As Rosen closed in on Balbi, Mashler lunged, stabbing the letter opener into Rosen's shoulder. Rosen screamed. Blood streamed down his jacket. Despite the wound, he felt lucky, convinced Mashler had been aiming for his heart.
"The fat bastard was going to kill me," Rosen would later tell anyone who'd listen.
He called the police, and Mashler was arrested and hauled off to a nearby station. Rosen wanted to press charges, but his boss, Kantrowitz, Mashler's longtime friend, asked him to cool his heels. So Rosen devised a plan. He arranged to meet Mashler at a city diner in Brooklyn.
"If you want to solve this, Shelley, pay me $50,000, Rosen said across the table, "or else I'm going to the police."
Rosen had no idea that Mashler was taping the conversation. Soon after the meeting, he told Rosen that if he filed charges, he'd sue him for extortion, and he had the tape to prove it. Rosen never filed. It was clear to Mashler that he'd shaken up a hornet's nest. Perhaps to escape more attacks from the likes of Rosen, in 1990 he moved Datech's trading operation to his home, 182 Kelly Boulevard in Heartland Village, a ramshackle neighborhood at the very center of Staten Island. He wanted to lay low, but that didn't mean he was slowing down for a second. He set up shop in his basement, a dank, low-ceilinged space decked out with a few fold-out card tables, a couple of dusty couches, and a large dog. Mashler's right-hand man, Mike McCarty, had an office on the first floor. In charge of Datech's books, McCarty was a terrifying enforcer of Mashler's decrees, with a volcanic temper that could explode in the face of any trader who wasn't pulling his weight. According to office legend, McCarty once ripped a Datech trader from his seat by the hair, dragged him screaming across the trading room, and tossed him out the door. Traders knew to never, ever fuck with McCarty. Levine stayed put at 50 Broad. He occasionally trekked out to the Mashler homestead to tinker with Datech's computers, taking the long ride on the Staten Island ferry from Lower Manhattan. He helped traders get news feeds by hacking into a Standard & Poor's service through satellite dishes on Mashler's roof. His first real business deal with Mashler was a beeper company. While they've been largely consigned to history's dustbin by handheld computers and phones, beepers in the 1980s represented the cutting edge of computer technology, delivering all kinds of information to their owners. Mashler had been an investor in a company that pushed sports scores to beepers, but had a falling out with his partners. He decided to launch his own sports beeper company and enlisted Levine and Citron to write the computer code in return for co-ownership in the outfit. Levine wrote the back-end paging code, while Citron wrote a billing system. Called SportsBox, Inc., and based at 50 Broad, it became one of the biggest sports beeper companies in the country. But more and more, Levine was working on Datech's trading system. He began logging monumental hours, often working through the night in his apartment or at a cramped office at 50 Broad, dozing off in front of a blinking terminal, struggling to bring what seemed like a fly-by-night day-trading boiler room into the information age. A major advance came in response to the booming volume at Datech, as traders such as Citron pushed the limits of SOs. All that volume created a number of logistical nightmares. Every day after the closing bell, Datech's traders had to tally up all of their moves on paper to figure out how much money they'd pocketed. Each trade was recorded on a printout from the NASDAQ Level 2 workstation, so they often had to pore through a stack of hundreds of pages. Looking for a way to simplify the process, Levine started working on a system that would allow a computer to scrape the relevant information from the trading blotter, the record of trades, on the NASDAQ Level 2 workstation, and input the data in a program. The program could then automatically keep track of each trader's profit and loss. He'd written similar programs for firms such as Tiger and the NYSE. The trouble was finding a way to channel the information off the Level 2 machine into a desktop computer. Levine quickly cooked up an idea. Why not route the signal from the printer cable in the workstation to a PC? Then he'd simply need to create a program to interpret the signal, sift out the relevant information, and track it. After a few weeks of trial and error, Levine came up with a program to do just that. He called it The Watcher. When it was first created in 1990, the Watcher was little more than an automated stock portfolio management system. It would keep track of, or watch, a trader's orders and positions, and calculate how much the trader had made, a task that in the dark ages of the late 1980s and early 90s was largely consigned to back-office clerks. Levine automated order management for Datech, giving traders the ability to see on their computer screens whether they were winning or losing. But Levine kept tweaking the program. As he did so, the Watcher evolved from a passive order tracking system to a state-of-the-art trading machine that could outgun the most sophisticated systems on Wall Street. The PC receiving the order information became the front end of the trading platform, the steering wheel driving the trade itself through the market's plumbing. Instead of manually placing orders through the slow, clunky Level 2 workstation, traders could buy and sell stocks through the Watcher itself using keyboard shortcuts designed by Levine. They could track multiple stocks at a glance, detecting from the shifts in the bids and offers whether a stock was going to rise or fall in the next minute. Levine's elegant programming enhanced the speed of the system, giving Datech's traders the ability to see shifts in the market before nearly everyone else. It provided flexibility and speed, and was a stepping stone towards something far more revolutionary. Turbocharged with Levine's skillful programming, the Watcher dramatically outpaced the Level 2 workstations market makers used, giving Datech traders a 360-degree look at the market's order flow and the ability to place orders far more rapidly than anyone else. And the stock market would never be the same. With the Watcher, as Forbes would state two decades later, a nation of day traders was born. But Levine's goal wasn't simply to bring day trading to the masses. Since working at Datech and learning more about how the market functioned, he'd conceived what amounted to the ultimate heresy on Wall Street. He wanted to make stock trading free for everyone by leveraging the power of the computer. It was a jaw-dropping vision. To make it a reality, Levine immersed himself in dense academic studies of market structure, a relatively new field that had sprouted in the 1970s and 80s. Finance professors were contemplating novel approaches to how markets worked, with an eye on making them more efficient. The literature could be wickedly complex, mind-bendingly arcane, long tomes full of obscure terms and difficult equations. Levine lapped it up. The book that left the most indelible impression was Reshaping the Equity Markets, a Guide for the 1990s, by Baruch finance professor Robert Schwartz. Schwartz's sweeping survey of markets in the United States and around the world, from Tokyo to Toronto, was a revelation to Levine. He learned about earlier efforts to create electronic markets, such as CATS, the computer-assisted trading system implemented in 1977 by the Toronto Stock Exchange, the world's first fully automated electronic trading system. Markets in Europe and Japan were also dabbling in electronic trading. Of course, none of those markets compared remotely in size or complexity to the United States stock market, Levine's chosen field of battle, which remained dominated by humans. Schwartz's book was the first place Levine came across an approach to the markets from an abstract, theoretical basis. The only problem, he disagreed with just about everything Schwartz wrote. On computerized trading, Schwartz wrote that while its advantage is the rapidity with which orders can be electronically transmitted and executed, the drawback is that speed may also have undesirable consequences if it is not properly controlled. Investors may be better off at times if the pace of events is slowed down. To Levine, that was nonsense. Slowing down trading was the prime tactic of the NASDAQ market maker who didn't want to honor his quote, who wanted to back away. One of the primary goals in Levine's ideal trading universe was speed. The faster the trading, the better. Speed forces market makers to be honest. It also encourages more transparency of the minute-by-minute ticks of the market. Instinctively, Levine believed the more visibility, the better. On Main Street, that was the vision of an idealist, a dreamer. On Wall Street, it was the ravings of a lunatic. But the madness would soon spread from Levine's inner sanctum across the nation, and in due course, the world. Indeed, the coming flood of free information unleashed by Levine's computer systems would put Daytech at the epicenter of the day trading explosion of the 1990s, which took off as more individual investors gained access to the market through the Internet using software such as the Watcher. The dot-com frenzy that would shake the nation's stock market to its core was gearing up, and Josh Levine was at the center of it. Mashler, of course, couldn't have cared less about the masses or making trading free. His goal was simple: to get filthy rich as quickly as possible. To capitalize on his new computer weapon, Mashler started hiring more and more young traders, often kids from Staten Island, fresh out of high school, with no trading experience at all. It became a Mashler trademark. Find a struggling, hungry kid from the streets who could never make it in the big leagues. Show him the ropes, make him rich, and win his loyalty. Shelley had a whole group that he brought in from Staten Island, recalls Moishe Zeltser, Daytech's longtime accountant. He acted as their father figure. He recognized talent. Even when guys were down and out, when he saw talent, he'd use it. And they were so devoted to him. Loyalty was the absolute rule. Chapter 7. Monster Key. One day in Shelley Mashler's basement, the new hub of Daytech's operation, a Staten Island trader named Joe Camarada and another trader agreed to race each other to see who could be the first to buy 1,000 shares of Apple for $24 a share. Camarada, rushing to get the order into the system, screwed up by putting the wrong stock symbol into his Watcher trading program. The other trader beat him to the punch on the first few hundred shares. In frustration, Camarada put in a new order to buy Apple for $28 a share. And it was filled instantly, at $24, beating the other trader. This was confusing. By rights, the trade should never have been filled, Camarada thought. He called a contact at NASDAQ and explained what had happened. His contact explained that the $28 order to buy was filled first because of a protocol known as price-time priority. Orders put into the NASDAQ order book were assigned a timestamp that prioritized orders with the same price. The earlier the order, the higher the priority. Orders with better prices, however, jumped to the front of the line, even if they were made later. And because another market maker was willing to sell for $24, that was the price Camarada got. A light bulb went on. Camarada realized that he could instantly buy or sell a stock for the best price in the order book. He put in another order to buy Apple for $50 a share, expecting to leap to the front of the queue. But the order was rejected. Calling his NASDAQ contact again, he learned that the system worked only for prices up to 20% higher or lower than the best bid or offer in the system. Camarada had unwittingly stumbled on a hidden loophole in SOZ. Price beats time. If he saw a bid or offer he wanted to hit, he simply needed to enter a price 20% away from the bid or offer, and the trade would be his, instantly. If a market maker were bidding to buy Apple for $24 a share and sell it for 24 and a quarter, a typical quarter point spread, and Camarada wanted to buy, he'd enter a bid for 1,000 shares 20% higher than 24 and a quarter, about $29. If he wanted to sell, he'd make an offer to sell for 19 and an eighth, roughly 20% lower than the bid. The advantage of this was simple. Often on SOZ, traders making the same bid and offer for a stock lined the queue. The trade went to the firm that placed the order first. Camarada had discovered a way to leap over the queue, make a ridiculous offer, and still get the best price. He could offer to buy Apple for $29, far higher than the going price, and get it for 24 and a quarter. To automate the process, he created a keyboard shortcut that gave him the ability to jump to the front of the queue at a moment's notice. And for weeks, he outpaced every other trader at Daytech. Some even thought he was cheating. But he kept his secret quick-draw gimmick to himself. Eventually, after another trader figured out his trick, Camarada decided to pass it on to Levine. The result was one of the most powerful stock trading tools of the 90s, the Monster Key, a program created by Levine inside the Watcher that gave traders the power to blast orders into SOs like a Tommy gun. Whenever they saw a trade they wanted to hit instantly, they simply typed in their order and punched the Monster Key. While Camarada ballparked the 20% difference in his head, the Monster Key program instantly calculated the price using an algorithm. Armed with the Monster Key, the Watcher now allowed traders to buy and sell stocks at a velocity never before seen. A trader could type a symbol into the Watcher and hit Shift B to buy 1,000 shares of a stock, or Shift S to sell 1,000. The algorithm behind the key would instantly calculate a price that was 20% up or down. The Monster Key was one of the original trading algos, among the first of a growing arsenal of digital weapons in a coming cyber war that would eventually marshal the most sophisticated techniques in computer science. The key could be dangerous, a sure way for reckless traders to lose massive sums of money. Good traders, however, could rack up huge profits. More trading algos would come. Levine designed bombs, then super bombs. They were the embryonic algos of the high-tech guerrillas, stealths, and snipers of the coming decade of the algo wars. At the time, Levine didn't have to worry about competitors. He was so far ahead of the pack that he was playing a game few even knew existed. While primitive, the Monster Key in its day was deadly. Citron, Camarada, and other Daytech traders began racking up huge gains trading on SOs. Using the key, you could be a high school dropout from the wrong side of the tracks and be a millionaire in a month, says Peter Stern, who in 1996 helped launch Daytech Online, Daytech's discount brokerage for day traders. There was one major problem with the guerrilla trading operation Levine, Citron, and Mashler were building at Daytech. NASDAQ had designed SOs for retail investors, not professional traders. To make it appear as if Daytech's orders were coming from regular investors, Mashler signed up nominee accounts for the firm and collected a small investment from the nominees. Daytech promised the nominees a fixed rate, say 12% of their investment. At the end of each trading day, Daytech would assign its SOs orders to the nominee accounts. Any profit above the fixed rate payments was pocketed by the house, Daytech itself. In short order, everyone at the firm signed up friends and relatives to Daytech accounts. It was easy money. Too easy. One person recalls that Citron told him that Daytech could provide him a guaranteed 30% annual return. Daytech effectively became a hedge fund clone with hundreds of small investors, including a number of grandmothers living in Queens, according to an SEC official who later investigated Daytech. The trouble was, SOS wasn't designed for hedge funds, and there were strict rules prohibiting such abuses. Mashler didn't care. In his eyes, NASDAQ was the corrupt operation. He was only giving it what it deserved. There were technical hurdles to overcome for Daytech's nominee system to work. Since every trade got a timestamp indicating when it was executed, it was difficult to retroactively assign trades to customer accounts. At first, traders would physically wind back the timestamp clock to the time the trade occurred and punch the ticket with the client's name. When Daytech's trading volume skyrocketed with innovations such as the Watcher and the Monster Key, this process became far too cumbersome. To solve the problem, Levine designed an automated computer system to allocate trades to nominee accounts and timestamp them. All profits above the fixed rate were transferred into Daytech's coffers. This system was called the Wire. There were other issues Mashler & Co. had to deal with, including the growing backlash from NASDAQ market makers and NASDAQ itself. "Are you threatening me?" shouted Peter, a market maker for the Minneapolis investment firm, Piper Jaffray. Peter was on the phone with Mashler, who was complaining about how Peter had handled a trade involving just 5 shares.
"What do you mean, am I threatening you?" growled Mashler. "I already have threatened you, you dumb Minneapolis cocksucker!"
Mashler slammed down the phone in disgust. Another market maker had backed away from his offer to trade his stock. It was a problem Datex traders were running into more and more. Since traders could only put in so many SOZ orders a day due to NASD restrictions, they were forced to execute some of their trades over SelectNet, the NASDAQ-operated system in which traders placed orders through a window on their Level 2 workstations. Since SelectNet wasn't automated, that gave the market makers an option. They could ignore the trade or back away from it. By law, they were supposed to execute the trade if it was the best price in the market. But NASDAQ market makers didn't always act as if the law applied to them. Worse, outside of SOZ, market makers weren't obligated to trade at their quoted price for more than 100 shares. Increasingly, Datex traders would punch in an order to buy a stock on SelectNet and watch in fury as the order sat there, ignored. When they picked up the phone to ask the market maker why he wasn't selling when the offer was right there on the screen for the world to see, more often than not, the answer was a terse, 100, sold 100. That meant the dealer had already sold 100 shares of the stock and the quote was stale, or so he said. The Datex traders knew when they were being lied to, and frequently erupted in profane outbursts, such as Mashler's tirade against Peter. Mashler knew the NASD enforced its rules when it wanted to. Increasingly, the regulator was training its guns on Datex. In 1991, the NASD fined Datex $10,000 and smacked Mashler himself with a $50,000 fine for violating SOZ rules. In May 1993, the NASD fined Mashler $5,000 and suspended him from trading for a day. The charge? Profane and indecorous language. An astonishing charge in an industry that was never known for its decorous language. The NASD complaint didn't include any specific examples of said language, but it did pile adjective upon adjective to communicate how indecorous it actually was. Calculated, graphic and protracted, sexually denigrating, gross, vile, and disgusting. In his defense, Mashler said the language stemmed from disputes over trades. He asserted his rights to free speech, adding for good measure that everybody did it. Traders can't say a sentence without cursing, he told the Wall Street Journal. There were other, far more serious charges. In 1993, the NASD found that Datex was splitting up SOZ orders into various trading accounts to get around its restrictions. It suspended Mashler and his entire Staten Island office from executing NASD transactions for 6 months. During the hearings, Mashler displayed a stunning irreverence toward the regulators. One day, he showed up in bathing trunks and a t-shirt that read, "NASDAQ sucks." The judge, outraged, tossed him out, telling him to come back in a different shirt the following day. Mashler did as ordered, wearing a t-shirt that read, "NASDAQ sucks," in different colors. Regulators were quickly crawling all over Mashler's ragtag office. One day, a typical one in the market for Datex, each trader sat staring at his watcher in Mashler's basement, all decked out in their standard work uniform. Baggy shorts, t-shirt, tennis shoes, or flip-flops. Suddenly, they all noticed an odd presence in the room. 2 men in crisp suits, looming in the stairwell door. Mashler exploded like a grenade. "Who the fuck are you?" he screamed, jumping from his seat and jabbing his Macanudo in the air. "We're from the SEC," one of the suits said. "We're looking for Sheldon Mashler."
"Who the fuck let you in?"
The door was open.
"If my fly was open, would you suck my dick?"
The Datex traders buckled in their seats, struggling to contain their laughter.
"Now get upstairs and ring the fucking bell," Mashler roared.
The 2 SEC officials sheepishly crept back upstairs and rang the bell. Mashler pressed the intercom button. "Hello, who is it?" he said calmly. There was a pause, then, "It's the SEC." "Come on down!" Mashler greeted them warmly, all smiles, backslapping. "Now, wasn't that easier?" he said, waving around his Macanudo and blowing smoke right into their faces. By 1994, as Daytech kept growing, Mashler had shut down his basement operation and moved back to 50 Broad. He understood that as the fight over Sows heated up, it was best to be in the center of the action, and as close as possible to Levine. He set up shop in a 10th-floor office, just down the hall from the programmer. In short order, Levine's peaceful research lab was transformed into a raucous frat house. His shoebox office was tight, cramped, crawling with computer gear. One small, grit-slathered window looked out over Broad Street. Baker's racks lined the wall from floor to ceiling. 2 dozen flickering PC monitors were sardined along the racks, displaying streaming rows of glowing digits. Coils of wires, Ethernet cables, and power cords snaked in all directions, finding egress into weird openings in the floors, walls, and ceiling, or just disappearing into mounds of trash. Trash was everywhere, on the racks, the tables, perched atop PCs. Mostly, of course, it was on the floor. The floor was trash. Chunks of ancient candy bars, apple cores, blackened orange peel, coffee grounds. Stacks of popular electronics and Investor's Business Daily. An oscilloscope. Milk cartons. Mostly empty plastic Coke bottles. Computer keyboards, several broken. An 18-inch lizard named Greg sat in a giant climate-controlled terrarium. The door often couldn't be closed because of the creeping clutter. With space so tight, Levine usually stood, furiously typing on several keyboards hooked to Dell computer towers. It was chaos, though to Levine it all seemed perfectly in order. If asked about a missing document or a research report, he'd plunge his arm into a seemingly indistinctive mound of junk and with a flourish retrieve the missing item. Directly outside Levine's den was another kind of barely controlled chaos, the Daytech trading room. A constant click-click-click blended with a fugue of profanity. Dozens of Daytech day traders sat hunched before long card tables, tense, eyes welded to their computer monitors, watching their watchers, banging keyboards, click-click-click, shouting, cursing, screaming, "Look at Microsoft!" or "Look at Intel!" or "Look at fucking Apple!" At other times, the room was dead silent as traders seemed hypnotized by their flowing screens. A silence interrupted only by the clicking of keys or the high-pitched squeals of mice stuck in the glue traps scattered about the floor. A haze of cigarette and cigar smoke hovered along the ceiling of the trading room, seeping into Levine's computer-lined cave. To his constant annoyance, he didn't smoke. It was a rough-and-tumble crowd, but they were hungry, young, and hard-working. The seasoned traders put the new recruits through their paces, showing them when to hit the bid, when to wait, when to get out of the way quick because the market was swinging against them. Their watcher orders, armed with the monster key, hit the market at top speed, gunned from their computers through dedicated T1 lines, high-speed cables that could transmit data at roughly 50 times the rate of a normal telephone hookup. They were Mashler's banded army, the rejects of Wall Street, the City College kids from the backwaters of Staten Island, Queens, and the Bronx, the ones who didn't stand a chance at a big bank like Goldman or Morgan. Dumb boiler room mutts. But they had a secret weapon, Josh Levine. With Levine creations such as the Watcher and the Monster Key at their fingertips, they could out-trade the very best in the business. They could grind Goldman to a pulp. They could make Morgan cry. A chomp his cigar, Mashler roamed the office like a wolf hunting fresh meat, constantly urging his traders to push the envelope, to trade faster, more aggressively, to destroy the NASDAQ market makers, his mortal enemies. Again and again he bellowed, "Fuck 'em! Fuck the bastards!" New recruits learned at the feet of top-dog traders like Citron, still in his mid-20s, or Mashler's eldest son, Eric. After a few weeks, cub traders were handed $300,000 to $400,000 to play with. Stakes could rise to $1 million or more. The traders kept a slice of their profits, and Datech pocketed the rest, with a fraction handed back to the nominees. Most traders focused on the high-volume stocks, like Microsoft and Intel, since they moved up and down a lot and were easy to jump in and out of. They were flat when the day began, and flat when it ended. In other words, no one held positions overnight, since news in the early morning or after the close could kill a position. All that trading, of course, wasn't going unnoticed on Wall Street or in Washington, D.C. Datech was now in the crosshairs of the most powerful securities regulators in the land, the SEC and the NASD. The SOS bandits, in the view of the regulators, were spreading like a virus. A 1992 NASD study found that 80% of SOS share volume in the 50 most active NASDAQ stocks came from the bandits. To protect itself, NASDAQ started to circle the wagons. It made a move to cut the number of shares a trader could buy or sell in a single pop from 1,000 to 500. It placed a limit on the number of SOS orders market makers had to honor, to one every 15 seconds. Then it tried to scrap the SOS mechanism altogether and replace it with a new system that gave market makers a 20-second grace period to decide whether to honor a quote, making it harder for bandits to ply their frenetic hit-and-run strategies. NASDAQ's efforts proved largely fruitless. It had little idea that a lone computer genius was crafting its demise from a ragtag office on the 10th floor of 50 Broad Street. Levine, ever fearless, knew the truth. The old boys were mired in the past. The Watcher, and software like it, was the future. Then he got help from an unlikely source, academia. In 1994, two finance professors, Bill Christie and Paul Schultz, published a groundbreaking study based on the trading data of NASDAQ stocks such as Apple and Intel. The two professors had noticed something very odd in the data. NASDAQ market makers rarely, if ever, posted an order at an odd eighth, as in $10 and an eighth, 10 and three-eighths, 10 and five-eighths, or 10 and seven-eighths. Recall that this was a time when stocks were quoted in fractions of a dollar, not pennies. Instead, they found that for heavily traded stocks such as Apple, market makers posted odd-eighth quotes roughly 1% of the time. When they looked at spreads for stocks on the NYSE, or American Stock Exchange by comparison, they found a consistent use of odd-eighths. That meant NASDAQ market makers must be deliberately colluding to keep spreads artificially wide. Instead of the minimum spread of 12.5 cents, one-eighth of a dollar, spreads were usually 25 or 50 cents wide. That extra 12.5 cents was coming directly out of the pockets of investors. Add it up, and NASDAQ's market makers were siphoning billions out of the pockets of investors. In early 1994, the two professors put their findings in a paper called Why Do NASDAQ Market Makers Avoid Odd-Eighth Quotes? Their findings, they wrote, raised the question of whether NASDAQ dealers implicitly collude to maintain wide spreads. The Los Angeles Times quickly picked up on the study. On May 26th, the paper ran an article stating that the Christie-Schultz study strongly suggests that the nation's brokerage firms collude with each other to rig over-the-counter trading and ensure themselves artificially high trading profits at the expense of investors. Inside the SEC, the study erupted like a bomb. The NASDAQ investigation was assigned to a staid, low-key attorney in the enforcement division named Leo Wang. Socially awkward, but aggressive as a pit bull, Wang had gained prestige within the commission for handling a high-profile bond manipulation case against Salomon Brothers in the early 1990s. In October 1994, the Justice Department launched an investigation into antitrust law violations by market makers. Wang began his own investigation in November. He started hammering NASDAQ dealers with subpoenas, demanding transaction records. He hit the jackpot when he forced the firms to hand over truckloads of tape recordings going back years. Traders had been oblivious to the recordings, which were made as a backup in the event of a dispute over the details of a trade. Inside the SEC, the enormity of the task of reviewing the tapes at first seemed daunting. It could take weeks, if not months, to comb through them for evidence of price fixing. But it proved all too easy. The very first tape Wang played revealed two dealers fixing prices.
"What can I do for you?" the first trader on the tape said. "Can you go one quarter bid for me?"
the second asked, using trader code to boost the price by 25 cents.
"Yeah, sure. I sold you 200 at one quarter. Just go up there, okay?"
"I'm goosing it, cuz,"
the first trader said, using trader lingo indicating that he was artificially raising the price.
"Thank you."
After the deal was finished, one of the traders, perhaps in enthusiasm over a job well done, struck a different sort of deal over the phone, a drug deal. The law was about to come down on NASDAQ like a sledgehammer. The investigations by the SEC and the Justice Department would result in a seismic restructuring of the stock market, helping to sideline human market makers and pave the way for the rise of the electronic pools. Indeed, it was that age-old human flaw that in many ways had set the stage for the rise of the machines on Wall Street. Greed. Waiting in the wings to pounce? Josh Levine and Datech. Levine sat ramrod straight in front of his computer screen. "Intel is at 111, he said excitedly, watching his watcher. Jeff Citron sat back in a large, squashed-looking leather chair, his feet propped on a card table piled high with bits of hardware, yellowing magazines, food wrappers, half-empty Coke cans. He smirked and ran a hand through his long, spindly hair. He knew exactly what Levine was thinking. "I have to do this," Levine said. Citron watched Levine with interest. He never ceased to be amazed by his enterprising companion. It was early 1996. A few years ago, in 1993, the two had officially teamed up, forming their own brokerage. Levine had also started his own broker-dealer, Big J Securities. Another company, called Smith Wall Associates, marketed their computer trading software, such as the Watcher. Datech, of course, was their number one customer. The location of all of these firms? 50 Broad. Despite the new ventures, Levine and Citron remained fiercely loyal to Datech and Mashler. Citron was personally in control of management and policies of Datech Securities. Levine, while never officially employed by Datech Securities, devoted most of his time toward building the software that ran Datech's trading machine. Levine never stopped tinkering with the Watcher, adding new tricks. He was determined to find more ways to circumvent NASDAQ's market makers, or to at least make them suffer. That day, all was relatively quiet in the office as Levine started typing. Since the best offer to buy Intel was at $111, he figured some witless market maker wouldn't notice if he dropped in an extra digit. Taking a breath, he typed in an offer to sell 1,000 shares of Intel for $1,111.25. And a market maker hit him. He broke into a dance.
"I made $1,000,000!" Levine shouted, shooting his arms into the air. "I made $1,000,000!"
"That was really stupid," Citron said, shaking his head. "You know what's going to happen next." Levine knew. Since market makers often focused squarely on the right side of the order, the fraction, they could be tricked into buying far too high or selling far too low. Mashler loved it because it showed the NASDAQ dealers for the subhuman apes he knew they were. Levine loved it because it forced them to be more honest, more aware. It was discipline. That day, he'd found the perfect opportunity.
The phone rang. A Datech trader picked up.
"It's about INC," he yelled out, using trader shorthand for Intel's ticker symbol, INTC.
Citron grabbed the phone.
"You the head trader?" he said. "Ah, you like that trade, huh? Not bad, huh?"
He knew the trade was a scratch, and negotiated to sell 1,000 Intel shares for 111.875. Still a tidy profit, but no million. Levine didn't care. He knew all along that he wasn't actually going to pocket $1,000,000. Such erroneous trades were routinely canceled. but in another part of his mind, a streaming virtual cyber world where the numbers on the screen were reality, he had made $1 million. With all its success, Datex started to change. Mashler began poaching recruits straight out of Ivy League schools, trying to burnish the firm's image, and, with luck, forged ties with influential power brokers through their blue blood connections. Many were making hundreds of thousands a year, if not millions. The dream job on Wall Street was no longer a cozy position with a white shoe investment bank. Now the young blood was gravitating to the quick draw hedge funds and day trading outfits like Datech. Training was fast and focused. Mashler was intent on ripping as much money out of Sows as he could before the candy store was shut down. We are slick, we are quick, we are smart, and yes, sometimes we take advantage of the system, Mashler told a reporter in 1995. I look at the gray area, and I find loopholes. Citron, for his part, had become a millionaire many times over, and he found plenty of extravagant ways to spend his newfound riches. Fine wines, mansions, jets, helicopters. What raised eyebrows wasn't that Citron, still in his 20s, was living like a Howard Hughes for the 1990s. It was where he got his new toys. Robert Brennan, the notorious First Jersey penny stock manipulator who'd employed Mashler in the 1980s. Brennan had declared bankruptcy in 1995 after being fined $75 million for a massive securities fraud, and was selling off the goodies he'd accumulated over the years from his ill-gotten gains. Mashler tipped off Citron to the fire sale. In 1996, Citron, freshly married, scooped up Brennan's sprawling estate perched on the Manasquan River in Brielle, New Jersey, a popular getaway for Wall Street moguls. He promptly bulldozed Brennan's mansion and built a new one for $3 million, including a copious wine cellar. He also bought Brennan's Gulfstream jet. While Mashler's connections with Brennan were clear-cut, the links between Citron and Brennan remained murky. Still, the appearance of close ties between the two cast a pall over Datech. The scandal-ridden Brennan had been connected to some of the sleaziest operations on Wall Street. Citron wasn't burnishing Datech's reputation by ostentatiously picking up Brennan's flashy possessions. Regulators took notice. They had been probing Datech for years, convinced its traders were manipulating the market through Sows. Mashler was constantly under the microscope of the NASD and had even attracted the attention of the Justice Department. The SEC was hesitant to go to Datech for information about NASDAQ market maker abuses, as it had with Harvey Houtkin, because of concerns about its potential ties to organized crime. Whether or not those concerns were justified, they hurt Datech's image in a business where reputation often meant everything. As Datech's visibility in the market grew, the scrutiny shifted toward Mashler's day-trading golden boy, Jeff Citron. For Levine, however, it was never about the money, not in the Wall Street sense, where everything was about the money. He seemed content to live life on a relatively small scale, renting an apartment in Battery Park in Manhattan, a 10-minute walk to the office. Rather than jetting to the Bahamas, he spent his weekends wandering the streets of Manhattan or Coney Island. His focus wasn't on making millions. It was on changing the market through computers. He struggled to keep the darker side of Mashler's operation at arm's length. Levine's sole interest in Datech was in using it as a Trojan horse to penetrate Wall Street and attack it from within. And it was working. His trick on the market maker with Intel was proof that humans were no good at matching orders between buyers and sellers. Beyond the larcenous spreads they charged, they were prone to boneheaded mistakes. A computer could do the job far quicker, cheaper, and mistake-free. Humans were in the way. Computers could make information free and let investors trade without the interference of the middlemen. The pieces were in place. Levine's dream was about to come alive, an electronic pool that brought investors together without middlemen, a pool that was open, seamless, fast, and free, an island. Chapter 8. The Island.
A bell rang. In a blink, Josh Levine hopped to the center of his cluttered office at 50 Broad and shimmied before a camera. It was one of the stranger manifestations of Levine's ethos of transparency. In 1995, the programmer had installed a video camera in a corner of his office that transmitted live images to his website, josh.com. "Live webcams," the site read. "Only a few will catch a random nosepick. Will you be one of them? Try your luck. It's free." Viewers would typically see Levine's crew-cut bullet head bent over his keyboard, the programmer typing, peering at his monitor, in ragged jeans, t-shirt, and flip-flops, a mound of crumpled trash and stacked computer gear looming behind him. If they looked hard enough, they might even see a large lizard sitting placidly in a giant terrarium. They may not have realized that Levine could track who watched the videos by the unique internet protocol numbers the viewers' computers used. His number one fan was a day trader based in New Jersey. Numbers 2 and 3 in a close tie, the SEC and the NASD. "If we're so crooked," Levine seemed to be asking regulators, "why would we put ourselves on screen day and night?" The website also included a button that read, "Ring the bell, make them dance." If the button was clicked by a viewer, an electronic bell rang in Levine's office, prompting the programmer to jump out of his chair and dance a jig like some crazed digital marionette. "They have been dinged," the site read above the live feed, with a vague reference to the new Fresh Air Annex. Anyone watching could reach only one conclusion. This was not your ordinary Wall Street operation. Something very different was going on at 50 Broad. Something revolutionary. While Levine's antics were a constant source of hilarity at Daytech, the traders had a profound respect for the impish programmer. Most thought Levine by far the most intelligent person they'd ever met, or ever would. And they thanked God in heaven that he was on their side. But there were complications that even Levine couldn't fix. The NASDAQ market makers and the waves of new rules and obstacles that NASD kept ramming out were a constant source of anxiety and outrage at Daytech. Market makers routinely ignored Daytech's SelectNet orders, backing away from their posted quotes, often leading to missed opportunities, or worse, significant losses as traders, struggling to get out of positions in a fast-moving market, were left flapping in the breeze. One way to get around the problem? Find a new pool to play in. A deep market filled with orders that Daytech's traders could work with. Aside from the NYSE, which is completely out of touch, there was only one other trading venue that fit the bill. Instanet. Instanet was the result of the efforts a small number of firms had been making for decades to work around the old boys' club of the New York Stock Exchange. Lots of brokers had NYSE-listed stocks on hand that they would have liked to buy or sell directly to one another, or to investors, in order to avoid the high fees charged by the NYSE middlemen. But it was difficult to get around the fact that the NYSE was the dominant meeting place for NYSE-listed stocks, among the largest public companies in the world. What's more, the NYSE's powerful interests erected all kinds of roadblocks, including lawsuits, to keep brokers from trading its stocks with one another. Still, these firms, including Bernie Madoff's broker-dealer, Bernard L. Madoff Investment Securities, kept trying. As such, Instanet had been founded in 1967 as Institutional Network. It was open only to institutional firms such as Fidelity and Merrill Lynch, in order to trade NYSE stocks. It had largely failed at its original goal, but it eventually became the largest electronic trading network for over-the-counter stocks, that is, non-NYSE stocks. It was renamed Instanet in the 1980s, and British media giant Reuters purchased the company for $110 million in 1987. Instanet was essentially a giant dark pool. Trading through Instanet was completely anonymous and usually took place through a dedicated Instanet computer. To trade through Instanet, a firm needed to rent the computer for a modest fee of about $1,000 a month. Firms also needed to pass through a credit committee that allowed access to the Instanet pool only to select members that carried a large amount of capital on their books, essentially locking out anyone without millions of dollars to throw around on fancy technology. In other words, it was yet another insider's club that Levine despised. Like NASDAQ's SelectNet, the
the InstaNet computer allowed firms to display their buy and sell orders on a computer screen. These orders weren't available to the general public. InstaNet reported transactions to the public only after they were completed. As important, the matching process wasn't automated. Living, breathing InstaNet traders sitting at desks in InstaNet's Midtown Manhattan headquarters did the actual grunt work of bringing the buy and sell orders together and settling the deal, usually through a few quick phone calls with the institutions themselves. Fidelity wants to buy 50,000 shares of IBM for $100, but Goldman wants to sell 100,000 for 100 and a quarter. If Fidelity takes 75,000, Goldman will sell for 100 and an eighth. Deal. Market makers steadily made inroads into InstaNet, which was designed primarily for institutions that made large trades. By the mid-1990s, it had become the largest venue for trading NASDAQ stocks next to NASDAQ itself, controlling roughly one-fifth of the volume. That's why Levine became interested in InstaNet. If watcher users could pipe into InstaNet's flow, they could bypass NASDAQ completely for many of their trades. No more backing away, no more crappy NASDAQ technology issues, no more NASDAQ bullshit. And while Levine detested InstaNet's closed system, he hated NASDAQ even more. Plus, InstaNet had better technology. And so in short order, he and Citron arranged a meeting with InstaNet executives at their 875 Third Avenue headquarters in Midtown Manhattan. Levine explained that the flow from the watcher would be a perfect match for the institutional orders that poured through InstaNet every day. It would increase InstaNet's liquidity for no cost. And since the watcher would substantially increase InstaNet's volume, Levine and Citron asked for a small reduction in the fees InstaNet charged its regular customers. They were turned down flat. "Fine," Citron said as they stood to leave. "We'll build our own system and we'll go head-to-head." The InstaNet response? Peals of chin-wagging laughter. Levine wasn't amused. And he knew something the InstaNet bigwigs didn't. Trading through the watcher was booming. While Citron's threat to create their own trading pool might have seemed like a joke to InstaNet, which counted the largest trading firms in the country as its clients, the reality was that by the mid-1990s, the prime growth market for exchanges was day traders, watchers' specialty. As competition ramped up, day trading was increasingly becoming a cutthroat business. SOS rooms were opening up around the country, spread by day trading prophets such as Harvey Houtkin. The ability to plug directly into the market through a computer and rapidly buy and sell stocks with a mouse click was a revelation for many would-be stock jockeys. This, of course, was well before online trading companies such as E-Trade and Ameritrade had become household names, their cloying commercials daily fare. For most people, the only way to get in on the Wall Street game was through a hometown broker. SOS changed all of that. The fact that the market was in the midst of a raging bull run propelled by high-tech powerhouses, Microsoft, Cisco Systems, Apple, and Intel didn't hurt. At Daytech, the armchair SOS traders, and even more seasoned pros like Harvey Houtkin, were gnats on the beast's back. The software they used was pathetically slow compared with the watcher. That didn't mean it was easy. Other sophisticated trading firms were getting in on the game. And the NASDAQ market makers were learning how to avoid the traps and tricks the SOS bandits had been using to destroy them. As the game got harder, the pressure on Daytech's growing ranks of traders became fierce. Citron and Mashler roamed the floor, packed warrens of cluttered card tables and sweat-drenched traders, fueled by fast food and caffeine and whatever other stimulants they could get their hands on. They sat hunched before their streaming tubes, jaws clenched, focused on the flickering data, baseball caps pulled tight over darting, bloodshot eyes. The trading room was dripping with testosterone. Ultra-competitive young men at close quarters, staring all day at a very tangible measurement of success on their screens. The day's profit and loss. Bad trades resulted in a screamed-out order to hit the floor and do 50. Fistfights broke out. Computer equipment was tossed about like nursery toys. Look up from your watcher,
You might see a keyboard or monitor cannonballing across the room into a pocked wall, its former user hunched over his desk, fuming at another trade gone sour. Management finally levied a $100 fine for anyone who destroyed a keyboard.